Russia is standing firm on its negotiating positions. What a shock that is. They have been consistent, well, since 2021, or you could go back to 2015 if you want, but all throughout this war, Europe continues to move around left and right, although mostly stable where they were, which is they don't want negotiations, they want more war. And the Trump administration is the one that seems to keep moving back and forth, and who can really tell where they are at any given moment. But we're going to try to figure out what all this means for this war. And one way or the other, this thing is going to eventually be settled, and it's going to come to an end one way or the other. And we have a great guest on to try to help us figure out where we are now, where we're going, and how we're going to get there. And that, of course, is Larry Johnson, so of Sonar 21, former CIA analyst, and at the Sun of the New American Revolution on Substack.com. And of course, that's Sonar 21 and Larry the Shirt Dressing Johnson, always a master of that. And he's not disappointed again today. So, Larry, welcome back to the show as always.
Yeah, I'm required in Florida. This is Florida business casual. You know, I think it's like a state law. Got to wear something. Well,
We got to follow the law. I mean, so I admire you for that. So yeah. Let's I just want to be on the record for that.
I'm always known for my conformity.
Some might have quibble with that.
Yeah, that may be questionable. You know,
well, listen, you've posted this piece here yesterday on Sonar 21, negotiating in Moscow on the negotiations. It's interesting because you kind of start that whole article off with talking about what's been publicly announced, and you know, Steve Witkoff and Jared Kushner. I still don't know why he's involved with this all of a sudden. Talking to Dmitriev has a role. Yushchev has said some things. Putin has met with Putin again, and there's the video on there. Everybody's happy and smiling. But as you pointed out, there's some people who were not there that might be important. I want to get to that in a second. First of all, I want to start off with what Yushchev actually did say and how he characterized these talks.
We could agree on some things, and the president confirmed this to his interlocutors. Others provoked criticism, and the president also did not hide our critical, even negative, attitude toward a number of proposals. But the main thing is that we had a very useful discussion. And most importantly, I would like to emphasize once again that the parties declared their readiness to continue working together to achieve a peaceful, long-term settlement in Ukraine.
I'm going to get to some of the things you mentioned in that article, but I want to ask a couple of questions that you didn't address there, which I think are important. The first one is the fact of who wasn't there, and I'm not talking about Sergei Lavrov at the moment. I'm talking about anybody from Ukraine or Europe that were not at these tables. What does that tell you about this discussion?
Well, as I noted at the title of my article, this wasn't about negotiating the fine points of what it's going to take to end the war. This was more Putin meeting with Witkoff, a friend, and Kushner family. Those two are going to go back and deliver the message to President Trump. No, the Russians aren't kidding. These are the non-negotiable points from which they're going to start. And related to that is, as Putin has made very clear, Zelensky is not a legal president of Ukraine. And Putin is only going to consider signing off on any peace deal with a legitimately elected leader of Ukraine. And so there's been rumor they're going to bring back Zelensky. He's not legitimately elected either. So, you know, Putin's laying that down as one of these are non-negotiable points. I think the Trump approach is everything's up in the air for negotiation and the normal real estate deals. You got to, you know, meet in the middle. Russia's got to make some concessions. Russia's not making concessions. That's what the West has got to understand. Russia is going to either achieve what it wants through diplomacy, or they're going to do it militarily. And so the fact that Ukraine's not there, and Europe's an irrelevancy, as Putin has said as well.
And some of the things that are non-negotiable, Yushchev mentioned there. He said some things we're just absolute opposed to. Some things we agree on. That's actually what Dmitriev said after the first leak of the 28 points. He said it's a good foundation to talk from. Putin himself went on camera to say it was a good foundation to start from, et cetera. But in terms of the things that are non-negotiables, as I see it, and you can add to or take away as you think is accurate, is one that the 28 points and subsequently changed in the so-called 19, 600,000 man Ukraine army, U.S. security guarantees, use of Russian frozen assets to pay for Ukraine reconstruction, and then the having to surrender portions of Kherson and Zaporizhia provinces and to not get them back at any point. Do you see anything else that Russia would consider non-negotiables?
Yeah, the no NATO presence in Ukraine.
Oh, yeah. How about I missed that? Yeah. That was actually in. That was one of the 20 points that there would be no NATO. But so they're actually in agreement with that, I suppose.
Yeah. So, I mean, it all goes back to the speech that Putin gave to the Russian Foreign Ministry on June 14th, 2024. He laid out, he said, look, here are points. Crimea, Zaporizhia, Kherson, Donetsk, Luhansk, those are now permanently part of Russia. They're not going back. We're not surrendering that territory. They are permanently part of Russia, period. Ukraine has got to hold elections. There has to be a new legally elected leader, but they can't be a Nazi or, you know, the or anyone affiliated with that famous corporal from Austria with a mustache that caused a lot of trouble in World War II.
That painter, if I recall.
Yeah, the painter, failed painter. That NATO's got to pull out of Ukraine. And, you know, then Russia will negotiate. They'll negotiate the end of that war. But those are the non-negotiable points. And the West just not listening. They keep thinking, oh, yeah, they don't mean it. They absolutely do mean it. That's, you know, that's what I keep trying to drive home. It's not the Larry Johnson belief. It is, this is what they've been saying it all along. So just listen. Okay, listen.
Yeah, and let's Gary has pulled up that for anybody who may not be familiar with it. It's probably good to remind people what hasn't changed for Russia is this from June 14th, 2024.
The essence of our proposal is not some kind of temporary truce or suspension of fire, as, for example, the West wants. This is not about freezing the conflict, but about its final completion. And I will say again, as soon as Kiev agrees to a similar course of events proposed today, agrees to the complete withdrawal of its troops from the DPR and LPR in the Zaporozhye and Kherson regions, and really begins this process, we are ready to begin negotiations without delaying them. I repeat, this is our principled position. Neutral, non-aligned, nuclear-free status of Ukraine, its demilitarization and denazification.
So what do you say to people who go, okay, well, like any negotiation, you always start with you ask for the maximalist, and then you know you're going to come back down from that because you're going to give and take the negotiations. What do you say to that?
Yeah, that's not how the Russians are thinking about this. This is about existential security. So this is the West now poses an existential threat, and Putin's going to disarm that one way or the other. They said he would like the negotiation, but he's laying out at the outset, we're not going to talk about this. You know, it's sort of like saying, hey, you can't have sex with children. And they say, okay, that's your opening bid, but let's find some middle ground. You know, no, there's something fundamentally wrong. And Putin is laying it out very clearly. We're not back. These are not items for discussion. Okay, and that's why Witkoff and Kushner went, and I think the reason Kushner accompanied Witkoff was so that when he goes back and talks to his father-in-law, that he's going to say, no, you know, hey, Dad, Steve's got it right. The Russians are very, very serious. They're not moving. They're not budging on this. There's no room for concession. So, because in the past, Witkoff.
I may be tempted to say out loud, which I now am going to do, that wasn't that pretty much directly face-to-face, mouth-to-mouth communicated by Vladimir Putin to Donald Trump to his face in Alaska?
I think, I'm not sure Putin was as direct.
Really?
Putin, you know, Putin tends to be pretty polite. He's a lawyer. I don't hold that against him. But, you know, he has a way of talking. But you know, I think this is why you didn't see Lavrov there, because they're not at the stage of actually negotiating the end of the conflict. These are negotiations over how we're going to negotiate. And so I think the way that the war has now turned dramatically against Ukraine, not only militarily, but economically, that it's now the Russians are in a even stronger position to press ahead with this is our take it or leave it. In fact, I saw, you know, in your recent debate where you abused that poor former general, Ben Hodges. I mean, good Lord. I almost called the cops. The man's kidding, taking a terrible beating here. But as you tried to point out to him, and he was incapable of comprehending it, the Russians had one negotiating position in March of 2022 in which they were willing to allow Ukraine to remain intact. They just wanted assurances, protection for the Russian speakers in the Donbass, and NATO the hell out of Ukraine. But that got rejected. So, boom, next position, you get June 14th, 2024, where now we're keeping all five territories, and you still got to get NATO out, and you got to hold elections. You know, those were the key demands. And then Putin has said since then that if you don't take that deal, the next deal is going to be even tougher. Again, the point you made with General Hodges. So that's where this is headed. And so I don't think this is going to result in any kind of quick agreement. The Russians.
Well, and in fact, from your Sonar 21 piece, two things I want to point out or ask you to elaborate on. One is that you said this is not the, I think you put it, this is not the end of the beginning, but it's not the beginning of the end, but it's the end of the beginning. What do you mean by that?
So the end of the beginning, this whole process, this whole dance about, okay, we want to, ideally, we want to get Ukraine and Russia to sit down like they did back in March of 2022. But Russia's not, you know, they're not, I guess Ukraine's not ready to do that. And Russia said, okay, so what we're doing, we're in this whole process is trying to arrange a situation in which there can be talks to end the war between Russia and Ukraine. But that's what I mean. With the conversation that took place yesterday for almost 5 hours, about 4.5 hours, was all about, it wasn't so much discussing the particular issues. It was Russia saying, okay, look, these are our non-negotiable points. These are the areas where we think we can have discussions. But one of those points is we're not going to sit down with Zelensky. And we're not going to sit down with Zelensky. Ukraine has got to have a legally authorized representative. And then we can make progress in talks with Ukraine, but not until. So this is all this beginning to, it's lining the orchestra up. It's distributing the sheets of music, but they haven't started playing the symphony.
Now, one of the other things you put in that article, which I think bears some discussion, is that you said it was is important who wasn't at this meeting too, not just Europeans and the Ukrainians, but Sergei Lavrov. And you said that there was something that Putin had said apparently in public a couple of weeks back or something about the centrality of Lavrov. And I wonder if you could explain that.
Yeah, when he was at Bishkek, held a press conference at the end of this collective security organization for the former Soviet republics. He was asked about the negotiations, and he basically said, look, there's a process here, and a critical element of that process is Sergei Lavrov. The foreign ministers got the lead on this, and then the others that will participate will be Medinsky, who has been, up to this point, the one that met with Ukrainians twice in Istanbul earlier this year, and Ushakov, who's the national security advisor to Putin. But Putin made a point that when those three are involved, that's when the whole actual negotiation is underway. So that's why what this meeting with Witkoff and Kushner, it's just prep. And I think it's prep more to get them in a position where that they can fully help President Trump understand the inflexibility of Russia on certain of these terms. But, you know, the political situation in Ukraine is really going to be the major stumbling block. Russia's not going to make any kind of deal, sign any kind of document with Ukraine until there are new elections and new leadership in Ukraine that are legally constituted. Putin is a lawyer, and he's a stickler for that. And the Russians generally are sticklers. And this goes to something else that, you know, Ben Hodges told you, oh, the Russians have broken every agreement. God, you know, how hard do you have to work to be that stupid? And so you go back and look. Yeah, the Russians walked away from the ABM treaty. Oh, no, that was George W. Bush. Hey, the Russians, they broke the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Agreement. No, that was Donald Trump. So, and they're the who's offered to stay in New START? Oh, that would be the Russians. So they can't point to a single agreement. And then, again, Hodges in his ignorance. Well, they broke the Minsk II agreement. Russia was not a signatory to Minsk II. That was an agreement between the government of Ukraine and the leaders of the Donbass. Russia was a guarantor of it, just like Germany and France. But what the critical difference there was, Germany and France said it was a deliberate ploy to buy time for Ukraine. So this notion that, you know, the Russians can't be trusted and they break agreements, they're very legalistic when it comes to this stuff and very professional about it. And it's watching the United States, the clown show that's going on over here. We'll know that the actual negotiations are underway when Marco Rubio sits down with Sergei Lavrov. When that happens, then we can say, okay, there are actual substantive talks underway to bring this thing to an end, at least from the standpoint of the United States.
Now, let's look at that aspect of things as well, because this gets even more complicated. It would be complicated enough just between the Russians and the United States, but of course you have to have Ukraine involved in there, and the Europeans want to be involved very much. But you mentioned Rubio. Interesting, he is not in Europe today, even though there is a foreign ministers conference at NATO.
Yeah.
His absence is very noteworthy. So he didn't go to Russia, and he didn't go to Europe, which seems to, there's a lot we can read into that. I'll get your thoughts on that in a second. But Mark Rutte, talking about that meeting today, had this odd thing to say about negotiations at some point starting.
And so to discuss the implementation of that summit, particularly when it comes to defense spending, ramping up to 5% on a credible path, defense industrial production, we have to do much more. We are doing better, but still a lot to be done. And of course, keeping Ukraine as strong as possible in the fight today, but also to be in the strongest possible position when peace talks really start to happen in a way where this could lead to a result.
So everything he talked about in the first part of that was spend more money, help Ukraine fight more, get more into the battle. And then later on, when negotiations start, even though by the time he was talking, probably the negotiators were still coming back from the meeting in Moscow, where we've been going back and forth many times since Trump got in. I mean, how much more in depth do you have to get before you're talking about starting them? What does that tell you about where the Europeans are?
Yeah, they're completely, they're completely irrelevant to the process. So they're on the outside looking in. They're trying to find a way to make themselves, to insert themselves into the process. And Putin has made it clear that we've got nothing to talk to you about. So, you know, you stay out. They recognize that the United States support is critical. Now, Steve Bryan, who's a former DOD official back under, I think, George H.W. Bush, he put out something yesterday. I hadn't heard it, but I think he's got very good sources. That now the U.S. has now cut off all military assistance to Ukraine within the last week. The items that were approved and by Congress and by Biden, no, they're not going forward now. And so when you couple, if that's true, and then you couple the fact that for the first time ever, the U.S. Secretary of State did not attend this NATO meeting, then Trump may have reached finally his the limit of his patience with the Ukrainians, because this is also playing out with the whole story of the corruption. And, you know, the $100 million is just the tip of the iceberg, but the whole corruption narrative has gotten some legs.
Well, where do you think that's going to go now and playing out? Because it's obviously an issue with at least some in Ukraine. I mean, with Mendich, I think his name was, and, the second one,
Umarov. Was it Umarov?
Oh, not Umarov, but Yermak.
Oh, Yermak.
Right. So they're right. Both having stepped back here. I mean, those are the, you could call them the right and left hand of Zelensky, and now they've both been dropped. I mean, at what point do you have to say that probably the left and the right hand had some connection with the body, which was Zelensky? But so far, he's just pretending it didn't happen. And it seems that most in the West are okay with pretending that way. How's that going to work out?
Yeah, well, I think if this was allowed to be fully unraveled and the sunlight exposed to all the darkness here, we discover that there have been payments made to people like von der Leyen, payments made to Kaja Kallas. It's on the Europe, a number of people on the European side that have profited from this. Paybacks.
You really think they would, though? Because, I mean, that would be the most catastrophic thing in the world to actually take. If there's any possibility of finding a trail that would just sabotage those people, I mean, why would they risk literally everything for a little bit of cash?
Agreed. I mean, you know, it's all relative. You know, how much, you know, one of my former business partners, when he started with DEA, he had this old experienced guy pull him aside and said, "Hey, Bobby, what's your price?" Bobby goes, what do you mean? He goes, "What's your price?" He says, "You're going to get offered money by criminals to allow, look the other way. And, you know, you'll put yourself at risk. Just figure out what your number is." And Bobby's go, "Well," and the guy said, "Let me help you." Said he went through this formula, figure out how many years you're going to work, multiply your salary over that time, figure out how much money you would take for you to sit in jail for 10 years. And he said, "So whatever number you come up with, that's your number. And if the bad guys come up and offer you more than that, take it. But if it's less, don't." Well, in this case, they had billions of dollars to toss around. And so, you know, someone's getting $10 million, $20 million. I know at least one Republican senator that I was told got around $16, $17 million. One Democrat senator got around $23 million. And there are apparently 21 more members of Congress. I don't know how many House of Representatives and how many in the Senate that have got substantial sums of money. So I know that that money has flowed to U.S. pockets, and I would be shocked to believe that it hasn't flown and, you know, made its way into the hands and pockets of several critical leaders in the EU. And in fact, we saw just yesterday they went after and picked up the former, if you will, foreign minister for the EU. She's charged with corruption, you know, so yeah, I'm sure that's going on. Now, will it be allowed to work its way through with all the guilty will be charged? I doubt it. I think the people in the high places are generally going to be protected, but there will be some fall guys. And one of those fall guys is named Volodymyr Zelensky.
Yeah, of course. I bet they have to be careful with that, too. If what you say is true, if the evidence validates that later on, I mean, I can see where you'd have a situation like the Epstein files, where nobody wants to let that information out because people on all sides of the political spectrum would get hit. And if they turn on Zelensky, I mean, unless they take him physically out, like to his life, I mean, then they have to run the risk of him, you know, talking and singing like a bird. So that's something that's got to be calculated as well.
Yeah.
Speaking of the Ukraine side, though, so you just saw Mark Rutte. All he wants to talk about is more military aid and whatnot. And so we'll talk about peace later on when, as Ursula von der Leyen said earlier today, the only language Russia understands is that of force. And so it seems that message got through to the Ukrainian Speaker of the Parliament, who a couple of days ago talked about his red lines.
You know that from the very first day of the war, Ukraine has been striving for a peace that respects our independence, sovereignty, and our dignity. Ukraine is ready for substantive negotiations on ending the war, including at the level of leaders. At the same time, we must designate the Ukrainian red lines, which no one has the right to cross, neither physically, nor legally, nor morally. No legal recognition of the Russian occupation of Ukrainian territories. No restrictions on Ukraine's defense forces. No veto on Ukraine's right to choose its future alliances. Any genuine peace process must be based on a very clear principle: nothing about Ukraine without Ukraine, and nothing about Europe without Europe.
So that's the mantra there that they really want. But help me make sense. If you talked to me, basically said that during this Witkoff meeting with Putin, that Putin laid out and said, here's our red lines. This is non-negotiable. Yeah. We won't do this. You're going to have to do that, et cetera. From a position of power and strength, that's an appropriate and understandable. Even if you don't like it, you can get it.
Right.
But this, make this make sense for me.
Well, it doesn't. But it's the... It's reminiscent of what happened to the German army and the German political leadership in April of 1945. Their Führer was moving imaginary armies around on the battle map and saying, we're going to do this, we're not going to do that. You know, you can indulge these fantasies all day long, but the reality is, and we don't just judge this in terms of military power, but by every single measure you can take, what is the industrial production capability of Russia vs. Ukraine? Superior, grossly superior. How about the in terms of the production of armaments, the weapon systems that are operable, that from hypersonic missiles to jet airplanes to cruise missile to drones, etc., and then the economy. Russia's got a debt to GDP ratio of 19%. Ukraine is now like 126%. So the point is, Russia is still in a position where it can finance the war. It doesn't have to go outside begging for money. Whereas Ukraine has no alternative but to beg for money. And then you look at who's Ukraine begging money from. It's everybody else who's broke. I mean, here's Germany, France, the UK. Their economies are in terrible shape. So, the military progress on the ground, the ability of Russia to recruit manpower to actually continue to build up its military strength, while Ukraine is going the opposite direction. It's bleeding manpower. And so you can't point to a single area where Ukraine has an advantage, not one.
There might be one, and that is on the narrative ability, because they really are good at that. And Volodymyr Zelensky provided a new one, by the way. And in light of what you just said about this whole political scandal about corruption and hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars and all that staining people, he has the audacity to say this.
War should not become a profitable business so that others would not want to repeat such actions. That is why we take principled positions on sanctions, on accountability for war crimes, on the legal status of our territories currently occupied by Russian forces, on Russian assets, and on the obligation of reconstruction. The aggressor must pay for the aggression. The stronger the world's united stance on these points, the more secure and lasting peace will be.
So the principal positions, I mean, what do you make of that?
These are portable principles. They're easily moved and conveniently displayed when he wants to. He's in his final days, I think. If he survives to the end of the year, I'll be surprised because this can...
There's not much left to this end of the year. That's a pretty short leash.
Yeah, the convergence of the events with the fall of Pokrovsk. I mean, that was go back and reference your debate with Ben Hodges. That was just a week ago, I think. And he said, "Yeah, look at Russia, man. They've been trying to take Pokrovsk for years. They can't get it." Well, that didn't last long. That lasted about 5 days.
That's all red, as you can see here. Yeah. Mirnograd's completely surrounded, about 2,000 troops inside of there. So that's not looking very good. Let me run down here to the south, because in the Zaporizhia area, where the Russians continue now, are making even more advances. And look how close to the outskirts of the city of Zaporizhia that is here. And then you look up on Huliapolia, where Russians have made even more advances. This is just the past 12 hours. They're moving up here. They've already have fire control and physical control over these roads. That's starting to go down. I mean, I could literally go all the way up the coastline here, but your point is made that's the taking of Pokrovsk and Mirnograd. Those are just the latest two, but nothing has slowed down.
Yeah, no, it's accelerating. And people I know that were previously thinking this would be a stalemate or that this could easily last to 2027. This one gentleman, a former Reagan Defense Department official, said yesterday, he says, you know, this could be over, you know, very, very, in fact, by year's end. He says that may be a little optimistic, but he says it's moving much, much faster than we had anticipated. So, you know, there's going to be a lot of coping taking place in the West. And that's, you know, that's another reason there is such a fury a flurry of activity of surrounding trying to get negotiations underway and trying to get Russia to make concessions, because they recognize how dire the military situation is for Ukraine. And as Putin has made clear, look, we're happy to sit down and talk, but we're going to accomplish these objectives either through talk or military means, but we're going to accomplish it. The two critical ones are demilitarization and denazification. That's it. If it comes down to those two critical things, they've been, you know, another point that you made in your debate with Hodges was the lack of strategic vision on the part of the West. I mean, what is it we're trying to do? What's the goal behind this military activity? And we're just throwing jello at the wall and seeing what sticks. Whereas Russia's been very clear from the outset, we're going to denazify and demilitarize Ukraine. And we're going to do it through force, or we're going to do it through diplomacy, or some combination of the two. And in fact, initially their plan, to, you know, when they deployed the 125,000 to 190,000 troops in February 2022, it worked. They did provoke Ukraine to sitting down in negotiations, and Ukraine came to a tentative deal until, under pressure from the West, it collapsed. So then Russia had to shift its strategy. Let me address one other thing, because I actually want your opinion on this. I think one of the main reasons that we've seen such an initial slow movement of Russia is even though they did the mobilization of about 320,000 in September of 2022, they didn't have enough forces in place to launch multiple axes of attack. Because it's not just the number of troops you can put forward in an attack. It's that once you occupy and control certain territory, do you have enough troops in place to hold that while other offensive operations continue? And I think that that's what we're seeing happen in 2025, is Russia finally got to a force level where they could both carry out multiple axes of attack and also have enough troops then to come to fill in, so they're not constantly, you know, you take territory, but then you stretch your lines of communication to the point that you can't defend them.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, I've actually argued that, I agree with you that the Russian in plan A, their strategic plan in February 2022 almost worked, but the fatal mistake that they made at that time was that they did not have a resourced plan B. And yeah. So when plan A fell apart, they were like, holy snap. And it took them like a year and a half to finally get the resources to do exactly what you said. Now then, however, they have those. And that very subject was also broached by Putin. I think it was yesterday when he was talking about all these things that you hear from Ursula von der Leyen, Mark Rutte, this Italian general who said we might have to get more aggressive with Russia, right, and might have to take preemptive action, et cetera. Putin was asked, what about that? What if there ends up being a conflict with Europe? Now, in his answer here, note what he says about how they are conducting the SMO as opposed to a full-on war.
I've said that 100 times. We have no plans of fighting against Europe. But if Europe wants to fight and they start this fight, then we are ready right now. There is no doubt about this. But the only question is, if Europe starts the war, unleashes this war, because that's not Ukraine. With Ukraine, we use some surgical means. We are trying to be really careful. Because you understand why. This is not a war in the direct sense of the word. And if Europe all of a sudden wants to start a war, and if it does start a war, then very rapidly, there might be a situation where we have no one to negotiate with.
And let me just point out that the significance, in my view, of that is that the situation is now reversed from where it was, where Russia is now resourced for a plan C, if you will, that could be a war with us. But because of all of our bleeding of all our capabilities, our draining of all our resources, and the paucity of which we have rebuilt our defense industrial base, and it is a little bit larger than it was, but it is nowhere near the scale that would be necessary. And it would take literal years, plural, to get to where Russia is right now. So I think that if there's a clash now, we're in, forget about the nuclear weapons, that would screw everybody. We'd be all the losers then. But if it stayed conventional, we'd be screwed.
Oh, yeah. And let's not forget, I mean, let's bring China into the picture, because China's restrictions on gallium, one of these, it's not really a rare earth mineral, but it is an essential mineral for the production of a lot of military equipment. China's got the market on that. They've almost got a monopoly. And without gallium, which they're now withholding from the United States cannot build a whole array of weapons systems. So, you know, there's a way in which the logistics chain on this also comes into play. And the other fact, you know, what most people don't understand, they think Putin's just using words carelessly, special military operation. The reason they call it a special military operation is they have not mobilized society for war. So I've been to Moscow, St. Petersburg, and Russia 6-7 times over the last 2 years, and you wouldn't know there's a war on. You know, it's not like they got recruiting posters up and, you know, support the troops posters. You know, you see that occasionally, but you really wouldn't know that there's a war on. If Russia went to war, they'd mobilize initially a minimum of 3 million reservists. Stas Kropivnik, who, you know, has been on your show, Stas was telling me, he says, we got 10 million reservists. He says, it's that big. Out of, you know, the population is like 140, 150 million. He says, but we got that many. And Russia would go all in at that point. But that also means they would target systems that so far over the course of 4 years in war with Ukraine, they've left alone. I mean, it was the same thing. I love referencing your debate with Hodges. You know, Hodges stupidly said, the Black Fleet, look at how the Black Fleet of Russia has been neutralized. And you correctly came out and said, well, no, the Russians they launch all these missiles from ships in the Black Sea. But the other thing that Hodges failed to understand, and again, that's why it's special military operation and not war, is Russia has left the ports of Odessa and other ports of that Ukraine's using alone, because the trade that's going out of there, some of it is going to members of BRICS countries and Global South countries where Russia's trying to maintain relationships. So Russia didn't want to do anything that could potentially damage the imports that these other countries are getting from Ukraine. In an event of a war, those ports are going to disappear. They're going to be shut down completely. So that's where, again, the difference between special military operation and war. So these NATO leaders, so-called leaders, that are talking so glibly about war with Russia, they have no idea what they're getting into.
Yeah. See, I think that we're still mentally believing what President Trump says all the time, what Pete Hegseth says all the time, that we are the greatest military alliance in the history of the world, present tense, not in the past. And they still think that that's true. And they think, yeah, Russia's, I mean, they kind of suck anyway. I mean, look what they've taken 1%, blah, blah, blah. You know that story. Yeah. I think we actually believe that. But there was something that Ursula von der Leyen said today, which I think is really illuminating in a way she has no idea, and would like your view on this. She was talking about the energy situation, how they have decoupled from a lot of the stuff that they had with Russia at the beginning of the war. And she's talking about how they have energy independence as a good thing.
This is the dawn of a new era. the era of Europe's full energy independence from Russia. Many believe this would be impossible. Well, the figures speak for themselves, and let me give you some. Today, Russian gas imports, so LNG and pipeline, are down from 45% at the beginning of the war to 13%. Coal imports are down from 51% at the beginning of the war to now 0%. And crude oil imports are down from 26% to 2% today. I always knew that we could deliver with unity, with resolve, and by building on the extraordinary work of the past 3 years.
Okay, a couple things you forgot in there that I would like your view on, plus whatever you're about to say, is that while you have so-called energy independence from Russia, you now have LNG dependence on the U.S. and at a much higher cost. Europe has had a significant cost to their economy because of having to purchase more expensive fuels from across the world. And you've made Russia nearly sanctions proof because they simply found other markets. And now then they are stronger and we are weaker. Congratulations.
Yeah, well done. You took the words right out of my mouth. I mean, you know,
I'm sorry,
damn it. No, look, she completely yelled, "Hey, we're free of paying less money for gas and oil and coal." And she, because built in there is the assumption, and this was reflected again by Ben Hodges, that they think that if they stop Russia from exporting oil, that Russia's economy is going to collapse. You know, I spoke with a friend of mine, John Polomy, who's actually of Russian heritage and is going to actually probably he's got family there. And he was saying, look, you know, right now the whole oil energy sector for Russia's overall economy accounts for about 8%. So, you know, what was going to Europe is, you know, not that much. It really is sort of inconsequential to Russia's economy. However, with the higher prices for energy that Europe is now paying instead of cheaper gas, cheaper oil, and cheaper coal, or more inexpensive is probably a better term. Well, it has damaged industry across the board and hurt consumers. But you know, fond of lying. Or von der Leyen, that's it. She's just fundamentally dishonest in this whole process. And again, I believe I will not be surprised that if we're going to learn someday, she was on the take. She was getting money for all these funds flowing to Ukraine. She was getting some kickbacks.
Larry, I think it's one of two things, and one of three things, I guess. Well, no, one of two things. Either you're on the take, and so that makes what those kind of comments that she's been making, not just this one, logical, because you want to keep the gravy train rolling, and because right. you have an incentive financially to do so. Or the other one is that she is just delusional, and I don't discount that possibility, because I think a lot of people and some of the folks we have, you know, we show sound bites off on the show, I think, that are sincere, but they are self-deluded, and they just can't see the truth. I don't know which it is, but all I know is that the net result for the people of Europe, and definitely for the people of Ukraine, it is catastrophic.
Yeah. Yeah. It's unnecessary. They continue to try to paint Russia and China as well as these aggressive imperialist carnivores who want to devour the world. And they're not content to stay at home. It's a complete lie. A complete lie. When you look at the history of both Russia and China, Russia never established itself like Germany, France, England, Denmark, as a colonial power, where they go into other countries around the world, take them over, extract their resources, impoverish the people, and celebrate it at home. That's never been Russia. Yeah, Russia's had attacks all along the fringe of its borders, because it occupies a large amount of territory, and it's faced a lot of invasions over the years, and there have been fights back and forth over who controls, you know, this part of Poland or that part of Romania. But Russia's never been one to go out and launch these military adventures overseas and just attack. They say, well, what about Syria? Yeah, They were invited into Syria by the government of Bashar al-Assad to fight an insurgency that was funded by the United States of America through my old outfit, the Central Intelligence Agency. So, Russia's always been in sort of this defensive position. And yet, Europe, who has been the legitimate, guilty one of imperial behavior, keeps projecting onto Russia the very things that the Europeans have done over the last 4 or 5 centuries.
Since you mentioned China, I did want to ask, because that was one of the things in your article that you put there on the negotiating about the negotiations. And you mentioned, and this didn't get hardly any notice at all in Western press, that the Chinese foreign minister, I believe it was
Wang Yi,
at the same time as Witkoff. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, I mean, if you've seen any of the video from it, man, I thought these guys were going to go out and start buying furniture together, okay? It was, hey, how you doing, buddy? Man, good, you know, smile. You know, you see Lavrov as animated as I've ever seen him. And Wang Yi, who usually is walking around with a poker face, man, he was smiling, grinning. You could tell they had a great personal relationship. And they talked about everything. They talked about basically how they're going to continue to cooperate on both economic, political, diplomatic, and military strategic affairs. They see it. They are in a partnership across the board. And you know what? I don't think that was just a coincidence that while Witkoff and Kushner are sitting down with Putin, Lavrov is sitting there with Wang Yi. And it's sending a message that, you know, this relationship with China and with the global South, it's a priority for Russia. And Russia's, you know, they're not going to be bullied. They're not going to change. And they're certainly not going to make themselves subservient to the United States. Those days are over.
Yeah. I think that's pretty self-evident based on the evidence, which we hasten that day. And we continue to deepen the fact that we have lost. I don't even think losing is the right term anymore. We've lost the ability to coerce or compel compliance on anything, economic, militarily, or otherwise. Culturally, especially on the Russian side, and we don't seem to have gotten that memo yet or realized it. I'm curious though, before I let you go here, you made a comment before we came on the air here about the debate I had with General Hodges on Mario Nafal. You said I would have asked some other questions or made some other comments. I wonder what you would have said had you been there.
Well, you know, I got the benefit of hindsight. You know, I'm sitting in front of the bleachers going, yeah, you should have said this. No, I thought, you did a spectacular job. But I would have, I would have pointed out to Hodges that, you know, he was maintaining that here's the West sitting, minding its own business. And Ukraine is just, you know, it's like playing with marbles on the floor. And then out of nowhere, the Russians attack them. And as you pointed out, I said, look, no, there's a history. I just would have added to it. Scott Horton's book, Provoked, provides detailed accounts of previous efforts by the West to provoke this very war. The other thing I would have hammered with him with is it said, because he's former head of, you know, I think he had a key role played with NATO. So, General, please explain to me why over the last 30 years, when NATO and European command conduct military exercises, that Ukraine has hosted more military exercises than 24 other countries that are members of NATO. What's that about? Explain that. And, oh, in our exercises, we never targeted Russia. You know what? Last I checked, that's what a horse puts out when they're walking down the road on a parade, okay? You got to step over it. I mean, come on. We don't call it Russia. We don't call it the Soviet Union, but it's people that live here to the east of us. I wonder who that could be. So, no, though I would, but those are minor points. I mean, you hit all the major ones, and, you know, the one I particularly applauded was his reference to the Black Sea Fleet. And then, man, you popped right in there with, hey, they're launching. I was thinking, damn, I should have thought of that, you know.
Appreciate your comments there, by the way. Before I let you go off here, we still have a few minutes left. I'd really, really like your view on what's going on down in Venezuela, because it seems to me we're almost set up where the Trump administration has boxed itself into a corner to where it nearly has to do something, or it will. Whether it should or shouldn't is certainly debatable. But because we have this, I think it's now up to 15,000 troops in the area. I think it's now 14 or 16 military vessels of various types. Yeah. And of course, the Gerald R. Ford is headlining all that. And Trump has apparently been on the phone with Maduro and gave him a deadline of about a week. And this was 2 or 3 days ago, leave the country or else. And then Maduro, his answer yesterday morning out in the open in Caracas was dancing around and just kind of in your face. And so it seems to me that he's called Trump's bluff. And so we're faced with either trying to put lipstick on a pig, which we don't do very well in the Trump administration, or giving some orders. And based on what our Secretary of War has done when he has the opportunity, they seem to be loving that kind of option. How do you see the situation playing out right now?
Reminds me, were you ever a Boy Scout? And did you go to scout camp in the summer and do archery?
I never did, but I saw it on movies.
Yeah. And so I'm talking the old style bows, not the compound bows. When you draw it back and you hold it, that's what we've got this bow and arrow and we're holding it, but we've now been trying to hold it in this position for 4 months, and your muscles start twitching and degrading. We have locked a weapon in a position that is ready to fire, but we're not firing. And I think part of it is there is a realization, at least among some, I think there's still some sane people at the Pentagon that and within a Southern Command that understand that we cannot militarily fight Venezuela. We're not in a position to do so. You go back and look at our total force level in Afghanistan, which we lost, was 140,000. Our total force that went in to Iraq was around 130,000. So we're not anywhere near from a troop level where, and again, we failed in both of those efforts to actually really win and come out on top. So we got 18,000 guys. And the problem with Venezuela, any ground operations are going to turn into a disaster for us, a total friggin' disaster, because the terrain, it's rougher than Vietnam. It's got higher mountains. It's got bigger jungle. And the borders, within Vietnam, you only had to worry about one border that was on the west side of Vietnam where the Ho Chi Minh Trail ran. Well, here you got two different borders. You got borders with Brazil and Colombia, the being the main ones that you got to worry about, that are open, that are impossible to control. And the weaponry that Venezuela has, they can fight back. They've got missiles that can, if they get them airborne, those missiles can take out some of our ships. And the odds that we can fend them off, this won't be like the Houthis. I think Venezuela has a more lethal arsenal for air-to-ship missiles, if you will, than the Houthis did. And so, this effort to use this posturing to threaten and cajole a change in Venezuela, I think it's actually starting to backfire. There was opposition in Venezuela to Maduro prior to this, but I think it's now having the exact opposite effect, that this is seen as U.S. bullying. And even people who were not previously supportive of Maduro are now like, they're back at Maduro. So I call this planning by virtue of watching too many Hollywood movies. We think that we can get out and posture, and all we got to do is show them, flex our military muscles, and these other countries are going to run and hide. They're not running and hiding. And Maduro is not isolated. He's in communication with Russia, with China, with Iran, with other countries in the global south. So I'm hoping cooler heads will prevail, because if the United States tries to do anything militarily, it's going to backfire on us badly.
Yeah, well, here's what President Trump has most recently said on that topic.
So we lost last year more than 200,000 people, dead people. ruined families beyond the 200,000. And those 200,000, their family will never be the same. But these people have killed over 200,000 people, actually killed over 200,000 people this year. And those numbers are down. Those numbers are down. They're way down. And they're down because we're doing these strikes, and we're going to start doing those strikes on land, too. You know, the land is much easier. It's much easier. And we know the routes they take. We know everything about them. We know where they live. We know where the bad ones live. And we're going to start that very soon, too.
Great news, Larry. As it turns out, we have all the information. Our intelligence is perfect. We know where all these guys live, and it'll be easier on the ground. What say you?
Yeah, what he just said there enrages me. My 39-year-old nephew died on the toilet about 60 feet from me here 3 years ago, a fentanyl overdose. So I don't need Donald Trump to tell me about who's killing who, because those drugs are coming into the United States primarily because U.S. corporations, U.S. banks facilitate it. It's not foreigners that facilitate it. It's us and our side. We clean up our act here, the problem goes away. It's not, but, you know, we don't take responsibility for ourselves. It's always easier to lay it off on the little brown people and we can kill them. And we can't kill our way out of this. Take the money. Stop the flow of money. And here's what Donald Trump does. He grants amnesty to a major Honduran drug trafficker.
Yeah, I don't understand why that didn't get more people upset.
And just pardoned Henry Cuellar, a member of Congress. Oh, he was just a victim of the Biden administration. The man was taking money from Mexican drug cartels. And I know that because we were involved with an investigation in that regard, and that's been going and going for 15 years. So I don't want to hear him lecturing about, oh, we're going to stop this drug trial. And when he's actually helping facilitate it, shame on him.
And what do you make about that, especially because you spent a lot of time in this part of the world, about the claim that, well, on the ground, it'll be easier than it is in the water.
Oh, man. Go visit those places. I've been there. You know, I've been to Venezuela. I've been to Colombia. I've lived in Honduras. I've been in, spent a lot of time in Panama and Ecuador. Yeah, Trump needs to get out of his office and travel a little bit. You understand that, you know, look at Colombia over a 40-year period fighting a civil war with the FARC and the ERP, the Ejército Revolucionario de Popular. They can't beat them. You don't.
It's too bad that the Colombian government didn't realize it was easy. If only they knew. Trump should have told him earlier, I guess.
Yeah. So, like I said, it's irresponsible of him to say this.
Well, and I'll tell you one thing that might be the most effective. Gary has actually come up with a really good idea about how we can solve this, and that's to have a dance-off between Maduro and Trump themselves. And you know, whoever wins, you know, that's it. And then the war will be over, and we don't have to, you know, it's kind of like two knots back in the day and, you know, fight for that. I mean, what do you think of that?
A dance fever. Hey, we bring back Dick Clark, resurrect him from the dead. He would be a great host for that.
Yeah, that's weird, man. I gotta say, man, this is statesmanship in the year 2025, and that passes on both sides. That's a problem all by itself, I guess.
Yeah, crazy.
I'm sure that probably Putin and Xi Jinping, don't you imagine probably the next entrance on there? I'm sure those videos are coming out soon, don't you?
Hey, it would be a much better way to settle conflicts anyway.
Yeah.
The only thing we'd have to worry about is pulled muscles and blisters.
Well, and nobody dies, so I'm all about that. But anyway, listen, really appreciate you as always. What a great show that we had on with you today. And just remind everybody to keep watching Sonar 21, because Larry's got all kinds of insider information and lots of experience in these things. And he gets to, you don't have to wait every week for him to be on our show. So turn in there. And in the meantime, we'll look forward to seeing you guys all on the next episode of the Daniel Davis Deep Dive.